Regan describes the symbolism of the triangle in substance as follows. The first side or line represents the mineral kingdom, which is the proper study for apprentices. The second line represents the vegetable kingdom, which the companions should learn to understand, because in this kingdom generation of bodies begins. The third line represents the animal kingdom, from the exploration of which the master mason must complete his education. It has been said of the Lodge of the Trinosophists that it was at one time the most intelligent society of Freemasons ever known. It adhered to the ancient landmarks but gave clearer and the more satisfactory interpretations to the symbols of Freemasonry than are afforded in the symbolical lodges. It practiced 5 degrees. In the third, candidates for initiation received a philosophic and astronomic explanation of the Hieramic legend. The Egyptianized interpretation of Freemasonic symbolism, which is so evident in the writings of Regan and other French Masonic scholars of the same period, such as Court de Gabelin and Alexandre Lannoye, is also present in the figures and text of the Strip Germain manuscript. In his comments on the Rite of Misraim, called the Egyptian Rite, Regan distinguishes 90 degrees of Masonic mysteries. The 1st to 33rd degrees he terms symbolic, the 34th to 66th degrees, philosophic, the 67th to 77th, mystic, and the 78th to 90th, Kabbalistic. The Egyptian Freemasonry of Cagliostro may also have been derived from Strip Germain or from some common body of Illuminists of whom Strip Germain was the moving spirit. Cagliostro's memoirs contain a direct statement of his initiation into the Order of Knights Templars at the hands of Strip Germain. Deluche gives what a modern writer on Cagliostro calls a fantastic account of the visit paid by Alessandro and his wife the Comtesse Felicitas to Strip Germain in Germany, and their subsequent initiation by him into the sect of the Rosicrucians, of which he was the Grand Master or Chief. There is nothing improbable in the assumption that Cagliostro secured La Tres Sainti Trinosophi from Strip Germain, and that the manuscript is in every respect an authentic ritual of this society. The word Trinosophi quite properly infers a triple meaning to the contents of the book, in other words that its meaning should be interpreted with the aid of 3 keys. From the symbolism it seems that one of these keys is alchemy, or soul, chemistry, another is Ionian Kabbalism, and the third Alexandrian Hermetism, the mysticism of the later Egyptians. From such fragments of the Rosicrucian lore as now exists, it is evident that the Brethren of the Rose Cross were especially addicted to these 3 forms of the ancient wisdom, and chose the symbols of these schools as the vehicles of their ideas. The technical task of decoding the hieroglyphics occurring throughout La Tres Sainti Trinosophi was assigned to Dr. Edward C. Getzinger, an eminent authority on ancient alphabets and languages, who is now engaged in the decoding of the primitive ciphers in the Book of Genesis. A few words from his notes will give an idea of the difficulties involved in decoding. Archaic writings are usually in one system of letters or characters, but those among the ancients who were in possession of the sacred mysteries of life and certain secret astronomical cycles never trusted this knowledge to ordinary writing, but devised secret codes by which they concealed their wisdom from the unworthy. Each of these communities or brotherhoods of the enlightened devised its own code. About 3000 B.C. only the initiates and their scribes could read and write. At that period the simpler methods of concealment were in vogue, one of which was to drop certain letters from words in such a manner that the remaining letters still formed a word which, however, conveyed an entirely different sense. As ages progressed other systems were invented, until human ingenuity was taxed to the utmost in an endeavor to conceal and yet perpetuate sacred knowledge. In order to decipher ancient writings of a religious or philosophic nature, it is first necessary to discover the code or method of concealment used by the scribe. In all my 20 years of experience as a reader of archaic writings, I have never encountered such ingenious codes and methods of concealment as are found in this manuscript. In only a few instances are complete phrases written in the same alphabet, usually 2 or 3 forms of writing are employed, with letters written upside down, reversed, or with the text written backwards. Vowels are often omitted, and at times several letters are missing with merely dots to indicate their number. Every combination of hieroglyphics seemed hopeless at the beginning, yet, after hours of alphabetic dissection, one familiar word would appear. This gave a clue as to the language used, and established a place where word combination might begin, and then a sentence would gradually unfold. The various texts are written in Chaldean Hebrew, Ionic Greek, Arabic, Syriac, cuneiform, Greek hieroglyphics, and ideographs. The key note throughout this material is that at the approach of the age when the leg of the grand man and the waterman of the zodiac shall meet in conjunction at the equinox and end a grand 400,000-year cycle. This points to a culmination of aeons, as mentioned in the Apocalypse, "Behold, I make a new heaven and a new earth," meaning a series of new cycles and a new humanity. The personage who gathered the material in this manuscript was indeed one whose spiritual understanding might be envied. He found these various texts in different parts of Europe, no doubt, and that he had a true knowledge of their import is proved by the fact that he attempted to conceal some 40 fragmentary ancient texts by scattering them within the lines of his own writing. Yet his own text does not appear to have any connection with these ancient writings. If a decipherer were to be guided by what this eminent scholar wrote, he would never decipher the mystery concealed within the cryptic words. There is a marvelous spiritual story written by this savant, and a more wonderful one he interwove within the pattern of his own narrative. The result is a story within a story. In the reprinting of the French text of the Trinosophia, the spelling and punctuation is according to the original. It has been impossible, however, to reproduce certain peculiarities of the calligraphy. In some cases the punctuation is obscure, accents are omitted, and dashes of varying lengths are inserted to fill out lines. The present manuscript is undoubtedly a copy, as Philotorm stated. The archaic characters and the hieroglyphics reveal minor imperfections of formation due to the copyist being unfamiliar with the alphabets employed. The considerable extent of the notes and commentaries has made it advisable to place them together at the end of the work rather than break up the continuity of the text by frequent interpolations. La Trecenti Trinosophi is not a manuscript for the tyro. Only deep study and consideration will unravel the complicated skein of its symbolism. Although the text matter is treated with the utmost simplicity, every line is a profound enigma. Careful perusal of the book, and meditation upon its contents, will convince the scholar that it has been well designated the most precious known manuscript of occultism. By Manly P. Hall, Secret Friend of Franz Hartmann, Forgotten Mystical Adept. The secret friend to Franz Hartmann is truly forgotten, as even her name is completely lost to history. All that remains is the record given to Franz Hartmann from this forgotten mystic of this fascinating mystical journey. Franz Hartmann leaves us with only a few words to describe how he came upon the manuscript in question. The following account of a psychic experience has been gathered from notes handed to me by a friend, a writer of considerable repute. Whether the adventures told therein are to be regarded as a dream, or an actual experience on the astral plane, I must leave to the reader to judge. The experiences of this completely forgotten mystic speak for themselves and begin with a prayerful inquiry. Unexpected revelations. The adept paused, and my mind was invaded by a multitude of questions to which I could find no answer. What is nature, and what is man? Why am I in this world? Did I exist before, and, if so, where did I come from? What is the object of my existence, and how will it end? Again the adept, reading my thoughts, answered, "Mortal man, as you know him, is an intellectual animal, living a sort of dream, life among dream, pictures which he mistakes for realities. Real man is a celestial being, a soul dwelling temporarily within a material body. Within this organism the spiritual, divine spark finds the proper soil to generate and develop the immortal man, as has been described by Saint Paul, who speaks of that spark of divine consciousness as being sown in corruption and raised in incorruption. This spiritual man is in each person his or her personal God and Redeemer. While a man is unacquainted with the processes going on in his invisible organism, He will have little power to guide and control these processes. He will resemble a plant, which is dependent for its growth on the elements which are unconsciously brought to it by the winds and the rains, or which may accidentally be found in its surroundings. It has neither the power to prevent nor to promote its own growth. But when man obtains a knowledge of the constitution of his own soul, when he becomes conscious of the processes going on in its organism and learns to guide and control them, he will be able to command his own growth. He will become free to select or to reject the psychic influences which come within his sphere. He will become his own master and attain, so to say, psychic locomotion. He will then be as much superior to a man without such knowledge and power as an animal is superior to a plant, for while an animal may go in search of its food and select or reject what it pleases, the plant is chained to its place and depends entirely on the conditions which that one place affords. The ignorant depends on the conditions prepared for him, the wise can choose his conditions himself. And what will be the end and object of this? I asked. The end of it, was the answer, is that the soul of man enjoys supreme bliss in realizing that she herself is everything and that there is nothing beyond her. The object is that mortal man shall become immortal, and a perfect instrument for the manifestation of divine wisdom. I heard the answer of the master, but I could not grasp its meaning. What could that soul be of which he spoke as being as big as the universe? And could my soul possess any other vehicle or organism than my visible material body? While I was meditating, the adept stepped with me to a window where the inaccessible mountain was seen, and pointing it out to me, he said, "Behold there the door by which you entered our stronghold. Concentrate your attention upon the way you came, and seek with the eye of your soul to penetrate to the other side of the mountain." I did so, and suddenly I found myself standing at that other side, upon the place where I had lain down to rest. Before me, upon the ground, was stretched out an apparently lifeless human figure, and to my horror I recognized it as being my own bodily self. At first everything seemed a dream, but then the thought came to me that I must have died. There was my body, and nevertheless I was myself, and saw myself such as I had always been, with all my organs and limbs and even the same clothing which the corpse before me wore. The hat of the corpse was drawn over its eyes, and I attempted to lift it, but I might just as well have tried to lift the inaccessible mountain. There was no physical strength within my arms. I realized that my present body consisted of a state of matter differing from that of the physical plane. I thought I must have died, and a feeling of disgust came over me, thinking that I had ever inhabited that now lifeless, grossly material form. I was so glad to be free, and had no wish to re-enter it. But an inner voice seemed to speak to me, saying that the time of my laboring in the mundane sphere had not yet ended, and that I must return. I even felt a sort of pity for that helpless body, and the sympathy caused thereby created a strong attraction. I felt myself drawn towards that body, and was about losing my consciousness when I was called away by hearing the voice of the master. I started as one who awakes from a dream. The adept stood by my side, and the vision was gone. "No, now, my friend," he said, "the difference between your physical and your psychical or astral organism. The divine soul has many vehicles through which it may act and manifest its powers." "But why," I asked, "are these things not recognized by academical science?" "On account of self, conceit," answered the adept. "The scientists, up to a very recent date, used to discard such questions as being unworthy of their consideration, and they preferred annihilation rather than confess that there was something in the wide expanse of nature which they did not already know. The theories advanced by the theologians were not more satisfactory than those of the scientists, for they believed, or professed to believe, that man was a complete being, in a finished state, with perfect freedom of will, and, as a punishment for his subsequent bad behavior, made a prisoner upon this planet. Furthermore, they were of the opinion that, if a man were leading a pious life, or, after leading a wicked life, obtained pardon for his sins and the favor of God, he would after his death become a celestial being, be ushered into a paradise, and live there forever in a state of never-ending enjoyment. It will be acknowledged now by every independent thinker, that these theories were not very satisfactory to those who desired to know the truth. But there was nothing either to prove or to contradict such assumptions, and, moreover, the multitude did not think. They paid their clergy to do their thinking for them. Since the publication of the secret doctrine, the opinions of the scientists and those of the theologians have been equally shaken to their foundations. The old truth which was known to the ancients, but which had been almost entirely forgotten during our modern age of materialism, that man is not a finished being, incapable of any further organic development, but that his body and his mind are continually subject to transformation and change, and that no transformation can take place where no substance exists, because force cannot exist without substance, has become almost universally known. It was demonstrated to the scientists that their science extended only to a very small portion of that mysterious being called man, that they only knew his outward appearance, his shell, but nothing of the living power acting within that mask which is called the physical body. It was demonstrated to the presumptuous theologians who believed that man's eternal welfare or damnation depended on their blessings or curses, that justice cannot be separated from God, and that man's salvation depends upon his own spiritual evolution. It was made logically comprehensible to the intellect that God in man will continue to live after all the lower and imperfect elements are dissolved, and that therefore a man in whom God did not exist in a state of divinity could not, after the death of his body, jump into a higher state for which he was not fit, and which he was not able to attain while alive. The exposition of the essential constitution of man, known to the Indian sages, described 300 years ago by Theophrastus Paracelsus, and again set forth more fully and clearly than ever before by H. P. Blavatsky and other theosophical writers, is calculated to humble the pride of the scientists and the vanity of the priests. When it is once more known and digested, it will prove to the learned how little they know, and it will draw the line for the legitimate activity of the clergyman as an instructor in morals. It proves that man is not already a god, as some had imagined themselves to be. It proves that he may look like an intellectual giant, and still be, spiritually considered, only a dwarf. It demonstrates that the law which governs the growth of organisms on the physical plane is not reversed when it acts upon the corresponding organisms on the psychical plane. It shows that out of nothing nothing can grow, but that wherever there is the germ of something, even if that germ is invisible, something may grow and develop. The growth of every germ and of every being, as far as we know it, depends on certain conditions. These conditions may be established either by means of the intellectual activity of the being itself, which has the power to surround itself by such conditions, or they may have been established by external causes, over which the being has no control. A plant or an animal cannot grow unless it receives the food and the stimulus which it requires. The intellect cannot expand unless it is fed with ideas and stimulated by reason to assimilate them. The soul cannot become strong unless she finds in the lower principles the nutriment required for the acquisition of strength, and is stimulated by the light of wisdom to select that which she requires. Here again the thought occurred to me, how agreeable and profitable it would be to live in such a Rosicrucian convent, where everything was rendered comfortable, no disturbing elements being admitted. To this the master answered, "One element necessary for the development of strength is resistance. If we enter one of the vast pine forests of the Alps, or of the Rocky Mountains in the United States, we find ourselves surrounded by towering trees, whose main trunks have very few branches. Upwards they rise like the masts of a ship, covered with a gray bark, naked, and without foliage. Only near the tops, that reach out of the shadows which they throw upon each other, the branches appear and spread up to the highest points, which wave their heads in the sunlight. These trees are all top, heavy, their chiefly or only well developed parts are their heads, and all the life which they extract from the ground and the air seems to mount to their tops, while the trunks, although increasing in size as the tree grows, are left undeveloped and bare of branches. Thus they may stand and grow from year to year, and reach a mature age, but some day, sooner or later, some dark clouds collect around the snowy peaks and assume a threatening aspect, The gleam of lightnings appears among the swelling masses. The sound of thunder is heard, bolts of liquid light dart from the rents in the clouds, and suddenly the storm sweeps down from the summit into the valley. Then the work of devastation begins. These top, heavy trees, having but little strength in their feet, are mowed down by the wind like so many stems of straw in a field of wheat. There they lie rank after rank, having tumbled over each other in their fall, and their corpses encumber the mountain sides. But at the edge of the timber, and outside of the main body of the forest, looking like outposts or sentinels near the lines of a battle, there are still here and there some solitary pines to whom the storm could do no harm. They have, on account of their isolated positions, been exposed to winds all their lives. They have become used to it and grown strong. They have not been protected and sheltered by their neighbors. They are not top, heavy, for their great strong branches grow out from the trunk a few feet above the soil, continuing up to the tops, and their roots have grown through the crevices of the rocks, holding on to them with an iron grasp. They have met with resistance since the time of their youth, and, by resisting, have gained their strength. Thus intellectual man, growing up protected by fashion and friends in a school, college, university, or perhaps within the walls of the convent, finds himself isolated from contrary influences and meets with but little resistance. Crowded together with those who think like him, he lives and thinks like the others. Over their heads waves the banner of some accepted authority, and upon that banner are inscribed certain dogmas in which they believe without ever daring to doubt their veracity. There they grow, throwing upon each other the shadow of their ignorance, and each prevents the others from seeing the sunlight of truth. There they cram their brains with authorized opinions, learning details of our illusory life which they mistake for the real existence. They become top, heavy, for all the energy which they receive from the universal fountain of life goes to supply the brain. The soul is left without supply. The strength of character, of which the heart is the seat, suffers. The intellect is overfed and the spirit is starved. Thus they may grow up and become proud of their knowledge, but perhaps some day new and strange ideas appear on the mental horizon, a wind begins to blow, and down tumbles the banner upon which their dogmas have been inscribed, and their pride tumbles down with it. But not only on the physical and the intellectual plane, in the realm of the emotions, too, the same law prevails. He who desires to develop strength must not be afraid of resistance. He must obtain strength in his feet. He must be prepared to meet the wind of the lower emotions, and not be overthrown when the storms of passion arise. He should force himself to remain in contact with that which is not according to his taste, and even to harmonies with that which appears inimical, for it is really his friend, because it can supply him with strength. He should learn to bear calumny and animosity, envy and opposition. He should learn to endure suffering, and to estimate life at its true value. The contrary influences to which he has been exposed may cause a tempest to rage through his heart, but when he has gained the power to command the tempest to cease and to say to the excited waves, "Be still," then will the first gleam of the rising sun appear in his heart, and before its warm glow the cold moonlight thrown out by the calculating and reflecting brain will grow pale. A new and still larger world than the external one will appear before his interior vision, in which he will be contented to live, and where he will find an inexhaustible source of happiness, unknown to those who live a life of the senses. Henceforth he will require no more to speculate reflectively about the truth, for he will see it clear in his own heart. Henceforth he will not be required to be exposed to storms, but may seek shelter in a tranquil place. Not because he is afraid of the storms, which can do him no harm, but because he wants to employ his energies for the full development of the newly awakened spiritual germ, instead of wasting them uselessly on the outward plane. What the disciple ought to seek is to strengthen his character, which constitutes his real individuality, keeping it always in harmony with the law of divine wisdom and love. A man without strength of character is without true individuality. Without self-reliance, moved only by the emotions which arise in his mind and which belong to powers foreign to his divine nature. Only after the attainment of a certain state of maturity, life in a solitude, isolated from contrary influences, becomes desirable and useful, and those who retire from the world as long as they need the world are attempting to ascend to the kingdom of heaven by beginning at the top of the ladder. Let him who needs the world remain in the world. The greater the temptations are by which he is surrounded, the greater will be his strength if he successfully resists. Only he who can control his mind and within his own mental sphere create the conditions which his spirit requires, is independent of all external conditions and free. He who cannot evolve a world within his own soul needs the external world to evolve his soul. Unspiritual men, therefore, who retire from the world because they are afraid of the world, cannot be considered to be heroes who have renounced the world. They deserve rather to be regarded as cowards who have deserted their ranks at the beginning of the battle with life. Such people sometimes retire into convents for the purpose of having a comfortable life, and in addition to that a ticket to heaven. They imagine they do a service to God by leading a harmless and useless life, for which imaginary service they expect to obtain a reward at the end of life. But the reward which they will receive will also exist merely in their imagination. As the sensualist wastes his time in the prosecution of useless pleasures, so the bigot wastes his time in useless ceremonies and prayers. The actions of the former are instigated by a desire for sensual pleasure in this life, those of the latter by the hope for pleasure in another life. Both are acting for the purpose of gratifying their own selfish desires. I am unable to see any essential difference between the motives and the morals of the two. But with spiritually developed man the case is entirely different. The divine spark in man exists independent of the conditions of relative space and time, it is eternal and self-existent. It cannot be angered by opposition, nor irritated by contradiction, nor be thrown into confusion by sophistry. If it has once become conscious of its own power, it will not require the stimulus needed by the physical organism and afforded by the impressions which come through the avenues of the senses from the outer world, for it is itself that stimulus which creates worlds within its own substance. It is the lord over all the animal elemental forces in the astral body of man, and their turmoil can neither educate nor degrade it, for it is divinity itself in its pure state, being eternal, unchangeable, and free. Do you mean to say, I asked, that all asceticism and self-denial is useless? And the master answered, it all depends upon the motive. All that the egotist does for his own selfish progress and aggrandizement is useless, it is done for an illusion, and increases his self-conceit. But this you will understand only when the consciousness of the divine state awakens within you, and you begin to realize the difference between your true and your elusive self. He in whom this divine principle has once awakened, he who has once practically experienced the inner life, who has visited the kingdom of heaven within his own soul, he who stands firm upon his feet, will no more need the educating influences of the contending storms of the outer world, to gain strength by resistance, nor will he experience any desire to return to the pleasures and tomfooleries of the world.